coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, well, well. Hello, everybody. How you doing? Chris Jordan here, your host. Episode 20. I am so excited, and even more excited to say that we officially have well over 50 hours of original content by our 20th episode, which was my plan. So glad to see things coming to fruition. Thank you so much for all of you who hung around through the label change, through the rebrand, and who have been there since the beginning. Thank you all of you who have joined us on our new platforms of Rumble and Minds, and what else are we on? Clout Hub. We're on another video one that I can't think of real quick. Oh my gosh, what is it? BitChute, hundreds and hundreds of views over there on all of those guys. So thank you to all of our new audience members over there. Also, thank you so much to our newest sponsor, the amazing Dr. Kimberly McGeorge of The Secret to Everything. Make sure to stop on by her website, secrettoeverything.com. That is where you can go for your own frequency healing sessions, for your own consultations, for your own alternative health advice, things like that. Stop on by, check her out, thesecrettoeverything.com. Make sure to stop on by our web stream sponsor, WebWorks Wireless as well. WebWorksWireless.com is the website. They are the folks that have been providing all of our live streams directly to our website and our app, which, hey, all the testing is done, folks. There it is. You can see the stream going right there. As of the 29th of April, we will be live out at the Bigfoot Roadshow in Mineola, Texas. If you scroll down to the bottom of the website there, you can see all of the active live on-location streams where we will be interviewing speakers, organizers, things like that. We will be going to the Bigfoot Roadshow. We're going to be going to the MUFON Symposium. We're going to be going to the Folk Monster Festival. We're going to be going to the Texas Bigfoot Film Festival, the Texas Bigfoot Festival, looking at the Wonderland UFO Festival, all kinds of fun stuff. Stop on by, check it out. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go. You can also download our free app if you're an Android user. So sorry, Orchard Dwellers, still trying to get that coded for you guys. But it's really, really hard because Apple doesn't want you loading things outside of their marketplace. And, well, they're a little bit invasive as far as a developer goes, and what you have to do to be a developer for them. Whereas Android, I can just pop it up on my website and you can download it directly. So hop on by, check that out. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go. CuriousRealm.com/app will take you directly to that download. 24/7 will take you to our new 24/7 random stream. If you're one of those random listeners who, hey, sure, I like things in order, but what happened a while back? Feel free to visit and just hit play, and it will randomly play an episode for you. While you're online checking that out, make sure to stop on by the website for our first guest this evening, Dr. Scott M. Taylor. NearDeathMeditations.com is the website. And I know that you may be thinking, near-death meditations, what's that all about? Well, we're going to be getting into it, folks. As many of you know, through my artist name, No Disassemble, I have been making binaural beat music for a while, and Dr. Taylor is actively one of the progenitors of the process that we speak about so much on this program, the hemisync process. The same process that, yes, we actively have the declassified documents from the CIA that they explored this process. And the possibilities of it. So we will be talking to the amazing Scott M. Taylor tonight about near-death experiences and binaural beats, how one could help simulate the other, how one can help us understand the other, and what that experience is like. We're going to be getting into that and so much more right after we do the news of the week. The news of the week is brought to you, of course, by our fantastic Facebook group and community over there. I just hit refresh because I know that there was a bunch of new stuff shared. Out of dailymail.uk, ex-Kremlin official and Gazprombank VP found dead in Moscow. He was apparently found dead with a gun in his hand, folks. CNBC.com tells us that the Secret Service has seized more than $102 million in crypto assets. Out of fizz.org, explanation for formation of abundant features on Europa bodes well for research for extraterrestrial life. Interesting stuff going on Europa. If you remember from Arthur C. Clarke's warning in 2010 in that movie, all these planets are yours except Europa, they said. Out of futurism.com, Elon Musk says he could make cat girl sex robots if he wanted to. Out of Fox 5 New York, and right here in Austin, Texas, this is talking about hand-implanted microchips could be used for contactless payment. And out of CNN.com, three U.S. sailors from the same aircraft carrier found dead in less than 1 week. Mysterious. They are still looking into that. That is the news of the week, folks. Feel free to stop on by Facebook. Join the conversation. Join the group. Follow us. Follow our guest. And follow the NearDeathMeditations.com website. Welcome to the show, Dr. Scott M. Taylor. How are you doing this evening?
I am doing just great this evening. And thank you, Chris, for the invitation. I have really been looking forward to coming on Curious Realms.
Oh, man. I like I said in our pre-interview, my body is all a tingle from excitement because I have followed your work and the work of the Monroe Institute, where this technology was first instituted. For years. So if you can tell us a little bit, Scott, about the hemisync process, what it was like working in the beginnings of this, what kind of spawned this research to begin with, because I'm an audio engineer by trade. That's how I came across this, was the first time I heard about entrainment. And the idea that by hearing a frequency regularly, that your brain could readily produce that frequency more readily. And granted, same way that you can go out and buy an ear training CD and you'll hear 1K. And the more you hear it, the more your ears will pick up on it. And you'll be able to register in a room like, ooh, that speaker's ringing at 1K. I can hear it. Same exact principle, except your brain actively starts creating the same waves that you're giving it. So,
let me jump in on please. That. So binaural beats are fascinating things. The Monroe Institute, Bob Monroe in particular, the founder of the Monroe Institute, was interested in a way of trying to figure out how to induce sleep in this hypnagogic state, because he knew that was really good for doing his explorations of out-of-body experiences. And he happened upon this old technology. It was discovered back in the late 1800s. And essentially what it is if you put a solid tone into one ear, say 100 hertz in your left ear, and you put 104 hertz into your right ear, the brain tries to equalize the two. Well, if you're wearing stereo headphones, it can't because they're inherently different.
Yes.
What happens then is that the brain says, okay, I'm shooting 100 hertz to one side of the brain, 104 to the other side of the brain, and it's trying to equalize the two. It can't. So instead, what it does is it sets up a third tone on its own. So the brain generates a tone that is the difference between the two. So yep. in this case, it would be 4 hertz. So you have 100 in the left, 104 in the right, and the brain starts to hear a third tone, which is 4. And then that magic word you were talking about comes in, entrainment.
Yes.
So the brain then starts to resonate with that particular tone. And so it starts to vibrate both hemispheres, acting in unison, start to resonate at 4 hertz. Well, if that were indeed the two tones we were feeding to you this evening, what would happen is that you would go into a deep sleep, because 4 hertz is delta sleep. And by adjusting the difference between the two, you can enter into various states of consciousness. Now, that's the technology that came out of the 1880s. The brilliance of Bob Monroe was, what if we could layer these tones? And so we put in 100, 104. So that would be asleep. Your body's asleep. And then we put in 100 and 112. So all of a sudden now we have another tone, which is the vibration of 12, which is the vibration of alertness. And so now all of a sudden we have two tones coming into the brain. One says body asleep. The other one says mind awake. And now all of a sudden you have the basis for what the Monroe Institute calls focus 10, which is mind awake, body asleep. It's that state of meditation
yeah.
where you are relaxed and you are alert. And that's the state that Bob Monroe did most of his early work in, when he was exploring the outer body experience and how to do it, where to go, what kind of tools you need to navigate around in the non-physical universe. That was the foundation for everything. And then later he began to go, oh, what if we played and we changed the intervals this way? And what if we added a third, a fourth, a fifth layer, you know? And essentially what happened is he experimented on everybody. This is the fun stories that can come out of Monroe is when, you know, Bob would go and he'd grab the postman or the UPS driver and say, come on, I need you to, you know, lay down here for a second, tell me what happens. And he just captured all kinds of people. But what happened was that he discovered these states of consciousness that took you to different places, states of expanded awareness, that state of one-pointedness, that state that's connected with heart energy,
yeah.
that bridge state that is the bridge between the physical and the non-physical. And that bridge state is where it's really easy to meet our dead relatives and communicate with non-physical beings, because they're having to slow their vibration a little bit. We're speeding up ours. And that's a beautiful state to do it in. And there's the state of one of the things we call the park, which is that area of life between lives. Each one of these is a different vibration, and he discovered them by just sheer force of will and trying all different sorts of things. And then when the equipment got more sophisticated, he could reverse engineer things. And the famous thing is he started working with world-class healers to discover if there was a vibration that energy healers use. And sure enough, there is. And so he was able to determine what that was and then reverse engineer it to create that tone so that people who are interested in doing healing work can do that and learn that frequency very quickly. It doesn't take years to learn. You can do it in an afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because some of the things that I know I've read are healing tones being pumped through burn wards.
Oh, sure.
And seeing an increased rate of healing. all kinds of things. And once again, I found binaural beats when I was about 19 years old, 19, 20 years old. I remember I was just old enough to enter a pawn shop in the state of Texas and buy something.
And one of the that's an interesting correlation.
One of the first, well, I remember because I had a long run of buying really great gear at pawn shops for insane prices. And my Voyager headset was one of them. And it was a little thing that you got at the Sharper Image. Mm-hmm. It was a little computer that you could like had a keypad and you would dial in like 019. And you'd look in the manual and like 019 was like a beta wave program, you know, and let's go through some beta waves and relax your body and, you know, have all the different benefits. And it came with a tape series that you could play at the same time. And it had a pair of goggles that whenever the tone occurred in the right ear, it would do the opposite thing in the left eye to basically stimulate the brain twice as fast. So, really, and that was my first introduction to binaural beats and to really deep diving in my life into the research of the Monroe Institute. Inside of that book was where it mentioned the Monroe Institute. And it was a search back in the day.
Because
I mean, this was like 1993, 1994, something like that. So it was before the internet that we know now, you know, and finding y'all and going to the library and looking things up and just, it was one of the first hardcore research things I ever remember taking on personally in my life, where it was like, I want to know more about this. Nowadays, I just Google stalk things, you know.
Well, that's one of the beautiful things about Bob Monroe. He wrote three books, and they were in general. There was like the first 10 years of his out-of-body exploration, the second 10 years, and the third 10 years. And what I remember about working for him in those early years was he made a consistent plea for everybody to try to understand what was going on in the non-physical universe, to try to put it into a concept. And then as you grew in your development and your skill level, if you found out that what you originally believed wasn't quite that, that was wonderful. And that's what I really liked about his three books is when you read them, you know, the first one lays out journeys out of the body, how he started out of body work, how he, where he went, who he met with. And then he tried to put some context around that. I think it works like this. But in the second book, he'd come back and say, remember what I told you in the first book? I have some more insights on that. and same way with the third book. So they are, it's like a diary of a true explorer who is running into things that they've never run into before. They are trying to put concepts around things they've never encountered before. And as they really begin to understand what's going on, they change their opinions based on new information. That is a beautiful thing. And it's one of the reasons that I really like the Monroe Institute, because it's not stuck in dogma.
Well, and it's real science. And I actually just saw a meme picture earlier today of, you know, Linus from the Peanuts, like, hey, you know, if you don't question science, you're kind of going against science. That's kind of what science is all about, is questioning science. And one of the reasons why we on this show use the term conspiracy hypothesis, because you're allowed to hypothesize anything. It's through experimentation that that becomes a theory. So, with that in mind, let's kind of talk about some of the people that were highly interested in the findings of Monroe and the Monroe Institute. And that is, of course, the document that I've been popping up, which is, of course, the declassified document that came out in 2010 about the CIA looking into the research of the Monroe Institute. And we recently had a whole episode about remote viewing and touched on the topic of how the CIA not only researched that, but had great success.
Yes, they did.
With that Stargate program, like to the point that it continued and continued and continued and is still used in many branches today. So let's talk about their interest in the Monroe Institute's research in binaural beats and the hemisync process and what that was all about.
Why, sure. You know, they had their first remote viewer was a guy by the name of Joe McMonagall. And he went down to investigate the Monroe Institute and found it to be really helpful for him. That what it meant for him was that up until this point, he had been practicing remote viewing, and it had taken him an hour or so to get into this deep meditative state where he could empty his mind and stay in that state for a protracted period enough so that he could get the information that he needed. And then, you know, he could draw it up and, you know, talk into a voice recorder, whatever it is that was appropriate at the time. Well, what the binaural beats allowed him to do is to shorten that period from an hour or more to 3 or 4 minutes. That this entrainment process that we were talking about earlier, there is a vibration that is the vibratory state that is most suited for remote viewing. And
oh, wow.
And so you can, once you've heard this tone, you know, 3-4 times, then what happens is that you can remember that tone. You don't need the headphones anymore. All you have to do is remember what the tone sounded like or what it felt like, and bam, you are right back in that space. And so that cool down period really helped him to be able to get into that meditative state that allows for remote viewing and to stay in that state clearly until he's done. And then off he went. And this report that is you pulled up was written by another viewer. So it's somebody else they sent down to the Monroe Institute. It's like, okay, we've had one guy do it. What do you think about what's going on here? And so he describes in this paper his week at the Monroe Institute. He took the Gateway course, which I taught for some 30 years. And he then goes on to hypothesize about why it works the way it does. And to be able to, well, a couple of things. I think he was trying to justify the money they spent sent him to the Monroe Institute, but also to try to put some meat around the bones on how he thought it might work. And that was really helpful. And I think it helped alleviate some of the concern at the CIA that this was, you know, a little woo-woo and it wasn't based in science and it is, and it had real results. And one of the things that happened last spring was that this whole report got somehow got onto TikTok and people got really interested in it again. And as you probably notice, it's missing page 26. And everybody thought that was, oh, my God, you know, the secrets of the universe are in page 26.
Yeah, and, yeah, right.
And, you know, they're not disclosing this for a reason. And there was a whole bunch of people who filed information, Freedom of Information Act disclosures.
I mean, There's more than that missing because mine only has 20 pages.
Oh, well.
And this is, and granted,
let me
folks,
know.
Just
send,
so you
I'll
know,
you the,
this
I'll send you the whole report.
Oh, I'd love that. I would love that because this is actually from Greenwald, from John Greenwald in the Black Vault, and they're pretty good about their FOIA requests, things like that, and they invite people. Please feel free to share our documents. Just make sure to keep our branding on it, like I did. Because this kind of stuff, it's pretty incredible. What the efficacy, once again, it was one thing for the CIA to dump a couple million bucks of black budget into Project Stargate, but to find the full-on efficacy of entrainment, and like you said, taking that time of finding, because even myself, as somebody, my first year in college was a seminary student, and
during that point
in my life and after, for a good 10 years, there was a time that, buddy, I could drop into that state at the drop of a hat.
Yep.
You give me 2 minutes by myself in a corner, and I could drop into a state of deep reflection and connection.
And one of the things that Joe has told me over and over again was that what they were trying to do in Stargate was to not have that sense of isolation.
Mm, yeah.
That so what was trying to do was to be able to drop into that state in the middle of a whole bunch of cubicles in the office. So there's phones ringing, there's people talking, right? So there's all of this distraction, you know, think casino.
Yeah.
And if you have that ability to go in deeply, quickly, if there's an emergency and you have to get information fast, you can do it. You don't have to go off into a corner. You don't have to be there for an hour. And let's face it, just from the terms of efficiency.
Exactly.
If you don't have to do an hour cool down every single time, you can get through a lot more sessions in a day than if you have that long period up front.
Yeah,
it's also a lot less tiring.
Absolutely, because and once again, I mean, when I was between 19 and 25, Scott, it was once again, I was at that point of connection and just working spiritually in the world regularly, you know, teaching, things like that. So I was going on retreats regularly, that kind of stuff. So it was very easy for me to drop into what I would call a state of ecstatic prayer. Where,
oh, lovely. I like that language. That's nice.
Where literally I could drop out and just be at connection with one, with what I knew to be one, and be calm and be listening and just be receiving. As I grew older and, well, now own my own business and do things like that, the monkey brain takes over a little bit more. And the binaural beats definitely helped me find that point of relaxation and release a lot faster. I find that I use them. I use them in conjunction actually with the Brainwave headband. I've got a Muse Brainwave headband to read my brain waves. And
so one of the things that was really valuable for me and my family was my former spouse had fibromyalgia really badly. And so much so that it was really difficult for her to walk or stand or sit. She just wasn't ever comfortable. She was always in pain. And when she started using the binaural beats, in particular, those frequencies they had in it, that remember we were talking about mind awake, body asleep?
Yeah.
That asleep part really helped restore her body. What we found out later is that many of the symptoms of fibromyalgia are because of sleep deprivation. Yep. And you can mitigate those symptoms to a large degree by using binaural beat frequencies that have that low tone in it. And it worked wonderfully. In fact, I created a business around it where I went around the country and sold exercises to people that had chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, actually anything with an autoimmune dysfunction has a component of sleep deprivation connected with it. And we were able to really help, take those symptoms that are caused by sleep deprivation and just, slowly make them go away. It was very gratifying work.
Well, and, being involved with research like that, once again, things that help alleviate people's regular everyday pain, things that help improve their literal quality of life. People do not realize not only, the healing quality of sleep.
I'll tell you one right now is that there's a whole series in the ME-Sync line that's about good quality sleep. And it, depending upon what, if you like music or you don't, do you like raindrops? I mean, they got all kinds of them and they're all lovely and they all work. But if you are a parent and you need that kid to go down, boy, is that helpful to just put it on a low volume and, those kids just drop right off. It's lovely. And for those sleep deprived parents who are all wound up because they had to go to work and then take care of the daycare and then the kid is sick or whatever, to help people fall asleep more quickly. Yeah.
And just to be fully shameless here, Scott, here's a track that I wrote called Theta Realm. That you can just hear the beat in the background of. But this is one that we have playing in our bedroom regularly at night, amongst things. And
isn't that lovely?
Yeah, the low end in it is just amazing. Once again, those are the healing tones. Those are the tones that you start getting into that are right near actual resonance of the earth, like Schumann resonance, things like that. And we talk so many times on this show, Scott, about everything is a frequency. Whether it's light, color, doesn't matter. It's all a frequency. For every color, there's a tone that matches it. It's the most amazing thing in the universe. Was it your work with the Monroe Institute and your work on binaural beats that led, was it a spiritual path that led you to that? Did that lead you to a spiritual path? Or was it your near-death experience that led you to a deeper spiritual understanding of this technology?
Scott. That's a great question, Chris. Thank you for asking. I had we didn't have a name for it back then, but I had a shared death experience back in 1981.
Oh, wow.
And they aren't very common. And in general, what it means is that somebody is making their transition. I was in the room at the time. And when they left their physical body, I went with them to the light. So, we left together and I had the chance to experience the light. Now, in a minute, I'll tell that story because it's kind of cool. But what that led to was one of the things that we know about people who've had near-death experiences is that it ignites this sense of curiosity. And for me, it was, if I can be in that light, if I have been in that light once, I know I can do it again. I just have to figure out how. And I mean, I went on a spiritual search like none other. I mean, I visited more cathedrals than you could shake a stick at. I went to Stonehenge and the Oracle of Delphi and the Grand Pyramids and the Sphinx and the minor pyramids, and I went to, you know, Machu Picchu. I studied with shamans in both North and South America. I studied with the Emoto religion in Japan, on and on and on. What I was trying to do is to find that spark, some residual energy that would help propel me into this space. And then I ran into a person in at the turnstile of LaGuardia Airport, actually, you know, where we were getting our bags. And they introduced me to the Monroe Institute, and I took a course there, and it was through the use of binaural beats that I was able to then go into that space. I was able to touch base again with those relatives and those loved ones that I had missed and, you know, had died before. And I was able to contact them and establish a, you know, a relationship and communication again. So it was the spiritual search that led me to Monroe. And then it was the discovery of how binaural beats can help you enter into the non-physical universe, hold you there long enough so that you can learn the tools and techniques for navigating in that space. I mean, they aren't hard, but you know, you need a little bit of time to kind of fuss around.
We recently had Dr. Kimberly McGeorge on, and that was part of our conversation with remote viewing, was the whole, because of course part of remote viewing is that concept kind of like astral projection, and there's this common sensation of falling. If you've ever had that dream, folks, where it's like, you're starting to go somewhere, and then all of a sudden it's like you fall back and wake up startled. That's that moment just before you break through that astral plane and go. And if you can get past that sensation, as you were just saying that, I've got goosebumps right now, because it occurred to me that the only times that I ever did not experience that sensation as I did dream work and fell asleep looking for an answer with purpose, things like that, was when I used binaural beats. Because once again, it's shortcutting that process, like you said, instead of going through that natural 30-40 minute process of, okay, now my brain is generating these waves, you know, it's shortcutted to that. And man, I never thought about that. Never even occurred to me experientially until just right now. What was your NDE experience like, and how did it echo your experience with the HemiSync process?
Well, thank you for asking, because this is a tender story for me. I was in love with a woman. Her name was Mary Frances, and she and her son Nolan had been out sailing. And on their way home, they were in this horrific car accident, and Mary Fran was killed outright. And her son Nolan, who just turned 7, had this mortal head injury.
Oh my God.
And so both Mary Fran and Nolan were transported. This happened in southern Minnesota. They were immediately taken to Mayo in Rochester, Minnesota, and they received, you know, terrific care. And it took Nolan about 6 days to make his transition. And in that 6 days, the family had time to gather. Mary Fran was one of 9 kids. And so, you know, there were boyfriends and girlfriends and spouses and cousins and nephews and grandma and grandpas. I mean, it was just this amazing collection of people that came to support Nolan. He was the eldest grandchild. And we each took 2-hour shifts. And on the morning, the sixth morning, I had the shift from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. with Mary Fran's eldest sister, Janie. And we, he was in a coma, but, you know, one of the things we know about people in coma is very often their hearing still works.
Yeah, they are still present.
They are still present. So we read stories to him. We told him what was going on with all this, all of his relatives. There were some really funny stories about his uncles and aunts sneaking around Mayo and stealing the cushions off of sofas so they could, you know, sleep on the floor of the waiting room. And you know, just things to keep him present.
Yeah.
Well, it gets to be about 4:45 in the morning, and Janie signals to me, and she looks at the chart at the bottom of his bed, and she looks at all the monitors. And she was a trauma nurse, so she knew where this was going, and and she signaled to me and said, "Scott, it's time. We need to say goodbye." So we sat next to Nolan's head, and we told him that we loved him, and that he had been fighting so hard, and he had been such a brave boy for all of the effort he was trying to put into staying with his family. But if his mother should come to pick him up, now remember, she died 6 days before. If his mother should come and pick him up, it was okay for Nolan to go with Mary Fran, that we would miss him terribly, but that would be the right thing to do. And we said our goodbyes, and at 5 o'clock we left, and another shift came in. Well, it was only 45 minutes later when the nurse on the floor came in, woke us all up, and said it was time. And we filed into the room, and as it just happens, I was at the end of the pack, so when I walked into the room, it was already 4 or 5 deep around the hospital bed. And so I wound up sitting on a windowsill next to Mary Fran's youngest brother, Willie. And you just wait, you know, and it's slowly his heart monitor goes down, and finally it flatlined. And when it did, what I witnessed, what I experienced was Mary Fran coming across the veil. She went to Nolan's and she scooped him up out of his physical body. And they had this exquisite reunion, just remarkable.
That is beautiful.
And somehow I got to be part of that. I got to feel what that was like as a mother reunites with her child. And then, completely to my surprise, the two of them turned to me and they embraced me, and the three of us went to the light. And once I was in the light with them, to say it was joyous, it was ecstasy, it was reuniting with the one of the universe. I mean, it's just so hard to describe, but it was anything. There's just beyond description how much love and compassion there is for the connection to the universe, but in particular, the connection between the three of us. And we had a chance for us then to communicate, not in words, but outside of words, our affection for each other. We had a chance to say our goodbyes and then just be in that space for a while. And then at some point, it was like we were done and it was complete. And the two of them turned and went further into the light, and I came back to my physical body. Well, that's only part A of the story. Part B of the story is that when I was in the light with Mary Fran and Nolan, I was also physically fully present in my body, sitting on the windowsill. We have a word for that now. It's called bilocation.
Bilocation.
I had two separate, fully functioning consciousnesses, and I know this because I realized how inappropriate I was for the room, because I am sitting there in this windowsill, and it's like the love of the universe is trying to break out through me. And my face is just filled with this radiance of joy and love. And if anybody had looked at me, they would have misunderstood.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I did the only thing I could think of, Chris, and that was to cover my face with my hands and just remain in that pose so that no one could see, you know, just how wonderful this space was. And then when I came back to my physical body and had a chance to reunite my two consciousnesses, I could bring my hands down and I could be fully present in the room for the other grieving relatives that were there. And, you know, we had a chance to say our goodbyes to Nolan's body and to each other as we, you know, drifted off and went home again. So that experience, you know, propelled me into a world that I didn't know existed. I grew up in southern Minnesota, and small town Presbyterian church, and let's just say having two consciousnesses isn't in the lexicon of the Presbyterian church.
It's not an option.
You just don't talk about that kind of stuff.
No, well, and you know, it's interesting because my audience knows, Scott, that what led me to my experience in the seminary was what I consider to be an ecstatic present experience where I was fully present with the universe, with the light. Like it was literally, and the only way I can explain it to people was I didn't hear a voice. I felt a presence, a vibration. And I felt a warmth pass through me and an ever presence of that warmth around me during my ecstatic experience that led me to explore the option.
I had the same thing. I did seminary. That was part of my part of my search, too.
And I think part of my problem with the seminary was when I got there and told some people about that. Yeah, like they looked at me like I was crazy. And I expected, I guess, well, more people there to be enlightened as to such a thing. It became something that I hid for a long, long time, and something that I just didn't tell people about to that extent.
And, yeah, me too. It was 15 years.
Yeah. And once again, like you said, to be present in that moment in both locations, looking back on it now, was it the fact that you were in tune and were already in tune because of your research? Like you were more readily in tune to that experience to begin with, the frequency of that experience.
I hadn't done my research yet. This was what started it all. And what I now know about shared death experiences as opposed to near-death experiences, because I had a shared experience with Nolan as he was going to the light and Mary Fran took me. What we know about those now is that anybody can have these experiences, but there's a couple of prerequisites, one of which is that there is a true heart connection between the person making their transition, in this case, it was Nolan, between Nolan and me, or Mary Fran and me. So a heart connection is important. And that the experiencer, needed to be receptive and open. And I was that way because, you know, when you're waiting for somebody to die, there's not a lot to do.
No.
You know, you're just sitting there watching and you kind of go into a meditative state just by waiting and being with everybody. And And the last part is, and I think this is really interesting, is that the invitation comes from the person making the transition. So the invitation came from Nolan, it came from Mary Fran, for me to join them. I don't know of it yet, of a case where it's the other way around. So Mary Fran and Nolan invited me into that process. And William Peters, who's the reigning expert on this, just released a book called At Heaven's Door, where he describes all this. He talks about how if you have an agreement ahead of time, that's enough to remind the person making the transition to reach back and pull you. So it's of those help within that.
It's interesting that you say that you were invited to experience because of your heart connection to both of those individuals and her welcoming him. His departure to her, she knew, meant just as much to you.
Yes.
And you know, it's interesting because the one thing that I taught teenagers for years after that was to listen to the tug behind your belly button.
Oh, yeah.
That's the closest thing you can get to what I experienced, is that feeling where you walk in somewhere and something just resonates through you and you go, I need to not be here right now. Like,
or listen, I need to be right here.
Or this is where I need to be. Why? And you go exploring. And, you know, it really is that fact of, you have to be open to it because, yeah, you're actively being invited to participate in this part of the frequency of the universe. And you have to be open to, well, that's what that feeling is the handshake. It's the invite. It's the wave or the head nod from across the room at the intergalactic party, you know, so to speak.
So that's the secret behind the work that I do. You've just put up that wonderful CD, bestseller, by the way. It took me a long time to figure this out, but the method that Monroe teaches, using the binaural beats and the tools and techniques for navigating the non-physical universe, can be adopted to recreating and going to the same places that near-death experiencers go to by using binaural beats and certain tools and techniques to be able to enter into expanded states of awareness and hold those states. And so what we know is that there are 19 common elements that are in a near-death experience, and they happen in clusters of vibrations. So when you leave your physical body for the last time, there is a vibratory state associated with that. As you go to the tunnel, that transitionary period between the physical world and the non-physical, there is a vibratory state associated with that. As is, once you're in the light, there's vibrations associated with that. And remember, there are three different kinds of light. There's white light, black light, and clear light. Each one of them has a different kind of experience. And then there's the reunion and the past life review and that time, we call it the park, that area of life between lives. Bob Monroe discovered it. It's also the same place that near-death experiencers go to. So we have two lenses that take us to the same area. So we know it's real. It's where the Akashic records are and the Healing and Regeneration Center, all that exists in the park. So what we have been able to do is to take the binaural beats, tweak them so that they are at the resonance of those different clusters. I call them vibratory windows, for lack of a good name.
Wow.
And And so if you're interested in, say, exploring the tunnel, which is a fabulous place, by the way.
Oh, I'm very interested.
Yeah,
I'm nothing but interested.
And so we use binaural beats. Hemi Saint made them for me, and we put them in that state, and I, you know, and using guided meditations, I gave you things to do so that you learn how to be in that state and what it's good for. Now, so that's the fun stuff.
I will say that is one area where your work specifically and the amazing albums that you have differ from the compositions that I put out, is that yours specifically have guided meditation attached to them.
Yes.
Things like that. Mine are much more open ended in the way of use this however the frequency does for it.
Well, you'll love this, Chris. So I put out that album you had put up there,
and
and it's got four different exercises to four different places.
Yeah,
and they're guided meditations. And the feedback I got, yeah, that's the one. Was, you know, after you've done it about 6 to 10 times, you know the drill.
Yeah.
And people would write back to me and go, would you please stop yapping in my ear? I just want to do this on my own. So that next one that down below there, where it says free flow meditation.
Yes.
That is like yours.
Okay.
Meaning that it's mostly an open period where you just have the binaural beats. Because you know what you're going, you know what you want to do, and you're open to experiences beyond what I've described for you in the guided meditations.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a progression. If I was smart, I would have put those in at the beginning, but, you know, you get smarter later. So I had to create a whole nother album just to give people that. So they didn't have to listen to me all the time.
But the thing is, though, is there is something to the guided meditation. As a former retreat leader, things like that, there is something to leading somebody down a particular path to an end goal. Mm-hmm. And there are definitely some people that We use the fraction 80-20 on this show regularly, Scott, where it's like, whether it's 20% of the people who took part in the American Revolution and 80% that were like, oh my God, you're a crazy person, or, you know, there's probably a good 80-20 to 70-30 that, much the same way that it's either religion or spirituality, that, it's either guided meditation or freeform meditation, and just give me the music, you know? I don't blame you for actively putting out guided meditation, things like that. That is something that is on a skill level and on a use case level, totally separate and different.
Yes, it is. And it really helps, to have a guide. It shortens the learning curve by just tremendously. And then once you learn how to enter into those states, hold those states, and you've got a couple of tools for how to get information or navigate in the non-physical universe, that just allows you to go and experiment on your own. And, you know, that's the part where you say, bless you. Go for it and come back and tell the rest of us what you find.
Yeah.
Because that's the fun part, is to hear people come back and go, did you know there's a center for humor? You can actually go there and figure out how jokes are created before they come here into the physical. You know, like, that never occurred to me.
And look at that. You got this in English, Spanish, Japanese, Italian. And I'm telling you, folks, the work that you have done here, Scott, to put all of this together, once again, I have followed when Michelle came to me, it was like, oh, this, I was like, oh my God, are you serious? Like, was like, Scott Taylor? Wow. Like, yeah, I want to interview Scott Taylor. Because your work and the work that you have done and the work in creating that unique HemiSync process, so amazing, so groundbreaking, so beautiful. And to be able to actively interview somebody who has impacted my life so deeply, not just as an individual and as a user of binaural beats, but as a musician. I hate to make the analogy, Scott, but it's kind of like I'm interviewing David Gilmour from Pink Floyd right now. One of those moments in life for me where it's like, wow, this is a true nerd out conversation.
Please know that I was not on the total nerd part of creating the HemiSync tones. My expertise is in how do you apply those tones and how do we tweak them to enter into states that have up till now been largely unexplored because we never had a pathway to do it.
And that's just it, though. That is what I immediately took this to. It was, let me do that. And that was the music that I made for myself. And like I told you in the pre-interview, like the hour-long piece, Prayer Ad Sodomum, that I wrote, that's all for children and people with ADHD brain who just can't go to sleep at night and are hyperactive. Things like that. That is exactly where that came from. And even to the fact of me using, I'm not going to lie, binaural beats in a targeted way. And when I say in a targeted way, I mean like in a way to make you feel uncomfortable in some of my avant-garde music, things like that. I would put tones and beats underneath things that were specifically made to make you feel very uncomfortable and uneasy while you listen to that piece of music, to give you a very visceral experience to listening. So even artistically, to use binaural beats in that way.
Well, I am of the opinion that we, even though binaural beats, I mean, the way HemiSync has done them, that's been around since the late 60s. And yet I think that we're, just on the beginning of all of what it is and how it was used. I mean, the tones that were created back then are still used today, but there's HemiSync 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. There's some real refinement as we discover different states of being that people can explore, soul clusters and what's beyond this realm here, the physical universe. And plus there's, all that other cool stuff besides out of body and remote viewing that, you can learn this stuff. Yes. I mean, you read it in the books and you go, wow, that'd be so cool. Well, go take the class. So can I do my commercial here?
Oh God. Yes. No, I was just about to say, I know that we are at our end of the hour with you. Number one, I want to have you on again and again and again and again in pre-recorded conversations where we can go longer than an hour. But please, yes, it is time for shameless self-promotion. Let everybody know where they can go to find your research, where they can go to keep up, where they can go to take workshops with you, where they can treatment.
So neardeathmeditations.com is my website, and thank you for showing that up on the screen. I appreciate it. There you can go and purchase either CDs or downloads of those albums that I was talking about. And that's a great way to start at home. Yeah. But if you're really serious about doing this work, There's nothing better than taking a 5.5-day course. And we patterned it after the courses that we taught at Monroe. And the benefit of it is that you're with another group of people. We max out at 25. That's as much as we take. And that ability to do the same exercise at the same time with people who want the same kind of results as you do, that group energy is remarkable. Yeah. Just remarkable. And whether you do it in Zoom or whether we do it in person, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. In fact, Zoom actually is a hair more efficacy. It's a little bit easier when you're remote. And yeah, it doesn't make any difference if you're in Switzerland and Hawaii and Australia. The first time I ran the course, we had people from 6 continents, which was unbelievable. It was wonderful. And if I'd been any smarter, I would have called up the weather station in Antarctica and given away a free one so I could say we did it in 7.
But, you know, that would not be a bad idea, would be to contact like the Antarctic research team. Even to contact people like the International Space Station.
Oh, wow.
And give them the experience while they're in space and see what the results are in zero gravity.
And so what happens is that people are able to enter into these expanded states of awareness. They're able to hold them. They learn the tools and techniques, and they get the benefit of 25 other lenses plus 2 instructors.
Wow.
You know, so when you're exploring the tunnel, for instance, you know, somebody will come back and say, you know, I noticed that there was a branch off this tunnel. Anybody else see a branch? And all of a sudden, you know, now there's new things to explore. Well, what does that mean? Is that 2 different timelines? Are they happening on the same time frame? It's all of a sudden all these questions come up that you can go back and explore. And it just allows the richness of the non-physical universe to come forth through the 27 people that are all doing the same thing at the same time. So it's a beautiful course. It's in its 8th year, so we have refined it and refined it.
Wow.
And it's really good. My co-instructor is Dr. Charlene Nicely, and she's an amazing trainer. And so the two of us just have a blast. We're sitting there talking about, you know, death and going to the light, you know, it all sounds very serious, but it really is more fun than one person should have.
Even my own personal experiences outside of any guided experiences like this by somebody like you, Scott, who once again have spent the better part of your life now researching this technology, applying this technology, and once again, getting your literal doctorate in the applications of technology like this. Thank you so much for your oeuvre of work, not just.
Oh, you get an extra point for that word.
Oh, thank you. I went to college long enough to be a doctor, but I hold no degree. I'm one of those guys.
and if people are interested about near-death experiences, I have a podcast. It's called The Afterlife Files.
Yes.
Just go to YouTube, type in The Afterlife Files, and you'll go there. Relatively recent. It's been going a couple of months. I've got 8 episodes that are up.
Oh, fantastic.
They're a little different than other podcasts in that the interview is the center section, and I introduce it by saying, listen for these 3 things. And at the end of it, I'll pick a point or two and go back in and say, you know, here's what the research says about X, Y, and Z. So it's got some, I think, some real depth to it.
Wow.
that is unavailable on some of the other podcasts that just feature stories.
Fantastic.
Thank you. Afterlife Files.
Yeah. That is really, really cool. And in addition to that, you've also got the Near Death Meditations channel on YouTube. So make sure that you go by and follow Scott Taylor, folks. Make sure that you stop on by the amazing website of neardeathmeditations.com. Once again, I cannot thank you enough for your time this evening, Doctor. This is quite literally one of my favorite topics. You can ask anybody that I go out and have drinks with when I'm on the road working.
Are drinks involved all the time talking to you?
No.
Okay.
Not all the time.
just messing with you, Chris. Yeah,
well, I mean, the show used to be called Dudes and Beer at one point, so.
Is that why it was taken?
but quite literally, the topic of binaural beats and their applications and what you can do with frequencies and sound and music in terms of therapy and healing and meditation are so just amazing. I want to thank you so much for your wealth of work, for your wealth of knowledge, and for sharing it with our audience tonight.
I've had a blast, Chris. Thank you so much for your invitation to join you.
Well, you are more than welcome back anytime. Once again, the conversation has been more than enjoyed on both sides, I assure you. Thank you so much for your time. We are going to get ready to go ahead and go to our commercial break, so we will let you go, but I will definitely be in touch with links for all this and everything else tomorrow, as everything will be posting tonight, so... Thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
And thank you, Chris. Have a good night.
Absolutely. Take care. We'll talk to you so soon. Man, what an incredible conversation, folks. I am here to tell you the topic of NDEs, the topic of out-of-body experience, the topic of what you can do with binaural beats in your brain and programming your brain. And even for all of you out there that are targeted individuals, I'm telling you, I am currently working on an album specifically for TIs, but make sure that you stop on by neardeathmeditations.com, neardeathmeditations.com/page CD is where you can go to buy all the albums. Once again, amazing stuff, amazing work. Such an incredible opportunity tonight. Stay tuned after these messages from our sponsors for our upcoming conversation with Merrill Fankhauser of the band Moo, of the all kinds of fun projects musically. He is one of the legends of surf guitar. We will be talking about the lost land of Moo, the many stories he collected about the land of Moo when he lived in Hawaii and Maui, and the Malibu anomaly. So we will be getting into all that right after these messages. We'll be right back, folks. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spigeric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training. And use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is podcastcadet.com. And we are back, everybody. Thank you so much to all of our fantastic sponsors out there, especially the amazing WebWorks Wireless. Their website is up. It's going. Feel free to contact them, folks. This is amazing stuff. True high speed, unlimited data. I'm here to tell you it's unlimited. Curious Realm is live streamed to our website every week with this. In 720p, I smooth put up 20 to 30 gigs of content every month with this exact system traveling across the country. It works. It's great. Stop on by. Check it out. WebWorksWireless.com is the website. In addition to that, welcome to our new sponsor, the secret of everything, the amazing Dr. Kimberly McGeorge, who is a regular guest on the show. Stop on by. Check out her website, the secret of everything. Sign up to receive one of the most popular programs. Your 20-day or 21-day frequency journey is free. Stop on by, sign up for that. I myself, in one of the first episodes that we ever featured Dr. Kimberly McGeorge in, did an aura reading. And it was quite literally, I sent her a picture of myself and she put it through her oral photography equipment, sent it back to me and did an analysis that was probably hands down. Like it would have had to have been a pretty sincere cold read to get things like, you're incredibly into crystals. Either that or you went and did a crazy amount of background research on me, deep diving into friends and stuff like that. But the information that she shared with me about my life, about my health, about everything that I am and that I love doing just from a simple picture was amazing. So stop by and check her out. TheSecretOfEverything.com is the website. Dr. Kimberly McGeorge, our guest in this segment. I am so, so happy to be featuring him. Merrill Frankhauser is a guitarist from bands like The Impacts, Merrill and the Exiles, one of my favorites of all time, Moo, as well as the Frankhauser Cassidy Band. Before we bring him on air, let's check out a track that he has for the Ukraine right now.
This is Merle Frankhauser. I'm sending out a special prayer in song to the people of Ukraine and everyone on Earth. From my Message to the Universe album, here is Peace in the World.
The days seem so long that I don't really think it's worth waiting. And the weeks pass so slowly, and I don't really think we are relating.
Welcome to the program, Merrill Frankhauser. How are you today?
I'm doing very good, Chris. Nice to talk to you.
Hey, I've got to turn it up for that guitar solo real quick. Hold on. That's just amazing. Man, like I was saying in our pre-interview conversation, Merrill, I found you early in my career as an audio engineer. When I mixed basically jam bands 2-3 nights a week, and I was rapidly getting into things like Quicksilver Messenger Service and Traffic and stuff like that. And one of the keyboardists was like, "You need to check out Moo." And I was like, "You mean like the legend of Moo, like Lemuria and Moo? Like I'm down with that, you know? Okay." And he's like, "Just go look at the band Moo. Go check them out." And he let me borrow a vinyl. And man, that was Band from the Lost Continent. And that to this day is one of my favorite, just amazing albums of composition that really takes you on a journey sonically.
So that was the first vinyl release from 1971 that had the picture of the band on the front, and the back had a big Moo symbol.
Yes.
That's the copy?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it first came out on RTV Era Records from Beverly Hills, and that was in 71. Then in 1974, it got issued on vinyl again on United Artists Records in London, and it took off in Europe and Japan and just everywhere. We were amazed. And by that time, we were living on the island of Maui. We had moved from California to Maui in 1973.
Wow. And especially as somebody who let's kind of hit the rewind button by just a few years in your career, because the Impacts is really where things started for you, which was, of course, the surf era, things like that. And you're obviously huge into surfing. so much so that it's even on your website. So let's start getting into what brought you into the world of music to begin with. I always love hearing people's journey into musicianship, you know, like how they found their path into it. Was it a group of friends in a garage? You know, was it like Jerry Garcia, where he was just laid up in a bed and had nothing better to do than learn a banjo? So what was it that first got you to pick up the instrument and first start? But was guitar your first instrument?
No. When I was 11 years old, I was living in Louisville, Kentucky, where I was born. My dad played guitar in a few Dixieland bands, and my mom actually sang with big bands.
Oh, wow.
And I used to just sing. They have a recording of me at 3 years old singing Zippity Doodah that they recorded on one of those record cutting machines in a department store.
Nice.
So he showed me these chords on the ukulele, and then we moved to California. He was a flight instructor, and he was tired. We were all tired of living in the snow and the cold. And he said, "We're moving to California." And I love that. So I got my first guitar around, latter part of 13 years old. And he started showing me chords on that. And right away, I just started writing songs. And then I got a gig cleaning up after the Saturday matinee at a theater here in California, where I live on the Central Coast. And there was nobody in the auditorium at that time. And I pulled out my guitar and started playing and singing. And the manager heard me and he said, "Hey, you've got a good voice." And then he offered me to play three tunes in between the two movies every Saturday.
Cool.
And he gave me $12 for that. And I said, "Oh, do I still get the $40 a week for cleanup?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." So that became a big hit. And some students at the local high school heard me, and they were musicians. And we formed the band, The Impacts, and played at high school things and little get-togethers. And then we got a job at the main auditorium that seated 1,500 people, and it had been going since the 40s. They had big bands there, and then went to country and western, and then a few of your old doo-wop groups like the Coasters and Little Anthony.
Oh, wow.
Played there, and they hired us as the house band Saturday, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday matinees. And we were discovered there by some producers, and they took us down to L.A., and in one day, we recorded a whole album because I had been surfing. The ballroom was just a stone's throw from the beach, and the term instrumental surf hadn't really been coined yet, Chris. So it was a new thing. And then along came, you know, other bands like Dick Dale was known as the father of instrumental surf. And we recorded this whole album in one day, and they couldn't believe it. They said only jazz bands can record a whole album. Well, I'd been writing these songs and putting surfing terms to them, and we'd been trying them out at the ballroom, and the kids loved it. And we went back home, and within a few months, our album was pressed, released, and everywhere.
And here it is, actually. Like you said, an incredibly seminal sound. Early surf music, tiki, things like that. They are so unique, and each has their total own voice. And you know, there's a lot of people that are like, oh, you know, Wipeout, so-and-so wrote that. Man, it was frequent the case that there were like 8 versions of the same song on the top 20 at the same time. Back in the day, much less songs with the same name that were about different stuff.
The two producers that recorded us, we did the first version, and it was, they copyrighted it and put it in their publishing. We knew nothing about copywriting.
Oh, yeah.
Or any of that. And, you know, Delphi Records, which was an established label that put out Ritchie Valens, and then they started putting out surf bands. Well, we didn't have any contract for it or anything. And they had us come back down. That was in 62. They had us, there was no other version of Wipeout out. They had us come down in 63, and ours only had one drum solo in the middle. And the producers said, oh, let's duplicate that drum solo every verse. And we looked at each other and thought, that's dumb, you know, not knowing. And so they played it for some other bands. One of them was a Safaris, which was 9 months later.
Yep.
And their version became the big hit. And our album did go on after years to sell 1 million copies. But Safaris and even the Beach Boys did a version of it. So. And the Ventures
did a version of it.
Yeah.
Like Gary Hoey and Joe Satriani, I believe it was. That would be a question for you right now is, what has it been like for you over the course of a career to see music like what you created in the impacts influenced so many other styles of music, from rockabilly to, you know, even a lot of the psychedelia of the later 60s, early 70s, and even on into movies like Pulp Fiction and stuff like that now, and the rebirth of surf
music, interesting
stuff like
thing
that.
Yeah, Chris, the interesting thing is that the Safaris actually covered one of our other songs, Blue Surf, and Steel Pier. And they gave me writer's credits on those, but they thought they changed Wipeout enough that they didn't have to give me credit on that one. So the hard thing for the band to handle was that we never got any royalties at first for the Delphi album. And then all of these bands were covering our song and some giving us credit and some not. And, oh, gosh, several years afterwards, I went down and had a meeting with Bob Keane, the president of the record company, Delphi, and told him this just wasn't right, and our fathers wanted to get an attorney, you know, and because we weren't getting any royalties. And he told us at that time that he had given the two producers, Hilder and Knowles, $28,000, which was a lot of money in the mid-60s. You could have bought a nice house for that. So when I went down and told him what was going to happen, all of a sudden, we started getting the royalty checks. And it wasn't really till 94 that we got some decent money out of it. And we didn't really realize that when we finally got a copy of the contract that they had sold, signed, it was for 52 years. And so Delphi had the rights to it till, you know, much later on, but then I got all the rights back and recopyrighted the songs. And the interesting thing, that same group of producers produced a lot of the early surf bands, like the Challengers and the Safaris and other bands. And they produced a Mexican band that had a hit, Land of a Thousand Dances, and it was called Cannibal and the Headhunters. Well, they ripped them off also. And one of the guys, they think it was from the band, caught one of the producers and shot him in the stomach.
Wow.
And he lived, but after that, he disappeared. Nobody could find him. Different bands had lawyers and investigators trying to find him, and they did. There was a rumor that he ended up somewhere in the Bahamas. And, I mean, that whole thing could have made
that's
a movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a movie plot, man. And the thing is, especially back in the early days of rock and roll, a lot of people are not aware of the fact that, I mean, you hear stories, there are a couple movies made about the artists that were done wrong, things like that, but even the fact of being able to pass on your rights to a family member, that wasn't a thing until here recently. And that was because of Jimi Hendrix leaving in his will, I want all my royalty money to go to my mom.
Yeah.
And that started a literally decades-long case over the rights of Jimi Hendrix. Between the label, who was like, nope, he's dead, we own all the rights now, and the family, who was like, but he left us the royalties. He left us his share of the rights. And only now can you do that.
I've got that in my will, and now I'm over 40 legal releases, 40 albums, because there are so many bootlegs all over in Europe.
Right.
And they mix years, which really frustrates me. They'll take songs from my next band, the vocal band, Merle and the Exiles, that was recorded from 64 to 67, and an album that we did in 67 called Fapperdockley is one of the most valuable and sought-after albums of the 60s, and it was a psychedelic folk album, and it's now worth $1,500 for a sealed copy. And, you know, this just went on, but it frustrated me, Chris, because these bootlegs in a lot in Italy and France and even Greece, they'd mix songs from the early albums from the 60s or even early 70s,
things like that,
and then they'd take stuff from 80s and things and say it was from that group. And you know, people that are devout record collectors know the history, and they go, this just isn't right.
Well,
so I have over 40 legal releases that I got something for after a while.
Good for you.
And I learned the business and knew copywriting and have my own publishing.
It's a business, Bubba.
But, you know, there are so many compilations out there that I didn't give rights to that I'm not getting paid for, and downright bootlegs.
And
so there's 128 releases that I know of researcher that did a discography book on me. And, you know, I'm only getting money for about 40 albums.
Man. And you know, once again, that goes right back to why if you go out nowadays and buy like a soul review album or like a Motown review album, sometimes like quite a bit of the time, if it's a modern produced one, you'll hear the remakes of it featuring the people because, well, they're allowed to remake it.
Yeah.
And once they remake it, they can now negotiate royalties for it. But if they're using the original track that was recorded in like 1958 at Motown Studios, Nope, they don't get dime one from the replay of that.
See, I went around to all the labels I was on when I got smart. I made sure when I signed something over to a label, I got the contract. There was nobody in between, and it was for a certain amount of years. And the master tapes came back to me.
Yep.
And some of them, like my HMS Bounty album from 1968, I had to go physically buy the rights back to that.
Wow.
Because another publisher was involved. And I went to the big building at MCA at Universal City here in LA, went into the tape library and bought my master tape back for that.
Wow.
And I now own all of the master tapes and the complete rights.
That's
to
beautiful.
My entire catalog.
Amazing. And I definitely want to have you on an episode of my Talking Sound podcast to specifically talk about protecting your rights as a musician.
I've shown more young musicians come to me and have me read their contracts, you know.
It is.
And I've helped a lot of young musicians.
It's such a point of pain. And I mean, you know, you bringing that up, especially what has it been like for you to work in some of these projects like Marilyn the Exiles, on the album HMS Bounty, things like that with folks like John Cipollina?
Yeah, John Cipollina didn't come along till, let's see, I was living on Maui and he came there and visited and we recorded in a studio on Maui in 1982.
Oh.
Then I brought the tapes back to California and added a couple more songs to them and finished it and made a deal with D-Town Records. Well, John and I were fast friends, and one of the early members of Quicksilver had already moved to Maui also when I moved there with my band Moo in 1973. And he would come and jam with us at our gigs.
Oh, wow.
And John came over, and I was surprised John already knew who I was and knew a lot of my music and said, oh, we got to get together and record. And we went in the only studio that was there and just called out some tunes we wanted to do. And I showed him a few of my originals and we went through them. I remember it was from about 12 in the afternoon till 11 o'clock at night with a break for pizza and just played all of this stuff without any rehearsal. And it was magical. And the guy in the studio was just blown away. And that was a real experience. And then going back to 1964 is when my dad took over a flight school out in the desert at Lancaster, California, near Palmdale. And I worked on the airport there, and there I was rehearsing, and a man that worked at the airport, Ralph Cotton, heard me playing, and he said, oh, my son Jeff is learning to play guitar. Come in town and play with him. And I had quit the Impacts and hadn't played with anybody in about a year, and I was ready to play. And Jeff and I hit it off right away, and we decided to form a band. And we found some other local musicians there and called it Merle and the Exiles. And we were discovered playing at a high school dance in Palmdale. And the head of Glenn Records, that was one of the only up-to-date studios that was up there in the desert, he just loved us. And he took us in, and I was writing vocals by then, and he did enough for 4 45s, 4 singles.
Wow.
And he progressively kept putting those out every 3 months, and they became big hits up there in the desert area in Bakersfield, and then it went down into San Fernando Valley. We were playing there. And in Hollywood on the Sunset Strip, and before we knew it, we started getting play in places like Ohio and Indiana and even New York and Florida. And
wow.
It was amazing. Wow. And then we kept recording. And in 1967, we had enough songs with a few other musicians that I'd met for him to put out an album. And he just randomly took songs off the shelf and put them together. And it was right when the psychedelic craze, you know, happened. And I went, Merle and the Exiles, that sounds too much like a 50s or 60s band. We got to come up with a far out name. So I took the first letters of each person's last name, F.A. for Fankhauser, P.A.R. for Parrish, the bass player at the time, and D.O. for Bill Dodd, the other guitar player. And then D.K.L.Y. for Dick Lee, who was the drummer. And I said, here's our new name, Fapper Dockley. And everybody cracked up. And he had RCA printed up, did a splendid job on the mastering and the you know, the pressing of it, and hired an artist to do this far-out picture on the cover. And when we went down to Hollywood to have the back picture taken, we were all in, you know, cardigan sweaters and stuff. And I said, oh, no, we don't look too far out enough, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
So the photographer said, well, I got some old curtains back there in the back, closet you guys could throw around you to look like robes. So that's what we did. And the album came out, and he sold the first 1,000 printing within a few wow. months, because they sold out in San Fernando Valley and Bakersfield and up there in Palmdale and Lancaster right away. And by the way, that area is where Captain Beefheart and his magic band and Frank Zappa both lived at the time when I first moved up there. And some of the members of my band, like Jeff Cotton, for a while went and played with Captain Beefheart.
Yep.
And then when I formed Moo, I had moved down to Woodland Hills, a suburb of L.A., and Jeff came down and joined me, and a few of the old Exiles did, and we formed Moo, and then we found that book, The Lost Continent of Moo, and that the Hawaiian Islands were believed to be part of it.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, we were a big hit in L.A. Our album, I remember, was even on a station in Cleveland, the first Moo album. And we told our record company and our promoter and agents and manager we were moving to the island of Maui.
Wow.
And they went, what? You're going to leave this behind? And I said, we're destined yep. to go there. And that was really a trip, because I went off in the jungle exploring and finding all of these pre-Hawaiian ruins that were there.
Wow. And here's a little bit of the band from the Lost Continent right now. See why jam band freaks like me love it. Now, this is where we segue, folks. This is where we start bringing in the other part of somebody's life and their passion. And that is the research that you've come across and the things that you've started researching since moving out there for this reason, right?
Yeah, we were just entranced with it, and that's how we decided to call the band Moo, because when Jeff Cotton got back together with me, and Randy Weimer on drums and Larry Willie on bass, they were both from one of the lineups of the Exiles, when we found that book, we just went, wow, that is something. And we just decided it was destiny for us to go there. And I'll never forget getting on the plane and leaving L.A. and going there. And we rented a house in a village near the rainforest. and I went off in the jungle looking for things, and the Hawaiians seemed to really like me, and they liked our band, and we played a sold-out concert in Lahaina, and since Hendrix had played there and filmed Rainbow Bridge, we were one of the only rock bands that played on the island. It was, you know, mostly Hawaiian music.
Yeah.
So some of these kids introduced me to their fathers and their grandfathers. And one old Hawaiian guy said, Merle, I know you're into move. I want to show you something. He showed me this valley, and this was, it gives me goosebumps to talk about it, Chris. There were these cut stone steps going down into this valley. And he said, I used to play down there as one little kid, but my parents told me, don't go down there or the Mu people will get you and take you away.
Whoa.
Yeah. So he said, I'm afraid to go down there. And he was in his 80s. He said, but you go down there and you'll find something. So I go down these stairs that looked like they'd been made with some kind of saws because they were too perfect. They weren't like what the Hawaiians made, which was basically stacked up lava boulders, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I get down there and there's a pristine waterfall going into this smaller pool, and on a stone cut platform looked like something the Mayans or Incans had made. There were three pillars that were at least 30 feet tall, and the edges were knurled. They almost looked like Grecian or something from the Mayans or Incans, but they were very well made, and one had broken off and was laying in a pool of water. And I noticed the same kind of stone steps went on down the valley along this beautiful stream. It was more like a creek that went down into the ocean. I followed those steps and had to go under the jungle and crawl in spots. And when I got down there, I saw the steps went out under the water, and I could see maybe 50 feet out. And the lava flow that had been there from thousands of years before went over the steps. So I knew those steps were older than that lava flow. And a German archaeological group came over there and carbon dated it. And they said those pillars and that platform were over 10,000 years old.
Oh, my God.
So that really sparked my interest. And I started asking all the old timers anything about odd ruins. And then the band Mu and I, we decided to hike through Haleakala Crater, which there were some scenes from Rainbow Bridge with Hendrix walking out there and the film crew. And we decided to hike through at 10,500 feet or hiking down this trail. And it was in the afternoon. And I looked way out in the lava flow and I saw what looked like a pyramid. And the guys went, wow, you're right. And you could only see it at a certain time of the day because the shadow of the rim of the crater, when it got at a later part in the afternoon, the shadow obscured it. So I had a camera, not a really good 35 millimeter. It was an old Brownie is what I remember. I started hiking over there and I went, oh man, this is treacherous. I was jumping these chasms that I'd looked down and it didn't look like there was any bottom to it in the lava, the dried lava. Well, it was tearing up my jeans and my boots, but I made it over to the pyramid and sure enough, I climbed up on the side of it and it was a smooth, sided pyramid. And I laid out my body and it seemed like it was about 40 feet sticking out of the lava flow. And then I got dizzy and got vertigo and felt like I was going to get sick. So I climbed down and then I very carefully got to a position where I could take a picture of it. and I got a good picture of it. Thank God I made it back to the trail. And, you know, I was so excited about this. I met a newspaper journalist from the local Maui newspaper and showed him the picture. He did a little article on it in the paper and put my name in there. The next thing I knew, the head of the park rangers was knocking on our door, and they didn't like that was put in the paper because it's so dangerous. They didn't want anybody, you know, to try to go out there and see it. And they said, we're not going to fine you now, but don't do anything else with this. And I assured them I wouldn't. And then many, many years later, they allowed National Geographic to go up there with a powered auger, and they drilled a hole in the side of it, and they concluded that it was a much bigger structure that went down under the lava flow.
Wow.
So that was a revelation. So then I heard from another Hawaiian surfer and fisherman that on the desolate side of Maui that you can't drive all the way around because the lava flows across there and the highway ends, and there's a rock trail if you climb over this lava embankment, and there's a whole ruined city out there. And I went out there with some people and a couple of cameras, and we were looking out, a few miles out, this stone trail with stone rock walls on the side, and we could see these structures. A lot of them were Hawaiian, but then you'd see underneath the Hawaiian, there'd be like another structure with the same kind of cut stone structure I found on the other side of the island. And I took pictures. And then about 7 miles out, there was a building that this surfer called Lost City Hall. And it had 4-foot thick walls. And it was about as big as a small drugstore. And over in the corner was a hole in the floor. Somebody had made a rickety ladder, and I could see where they'd made torches out of things. So I went down there. And there was the same kind of floor structure, cut stone and walls, and two of the same identical stone pillars on each side of the wall. And it was like a basement under this building. I tried to take pictures, and the darn camera was out of film, and the battery in it was dead because I'd been going crazy. Well, I later found out and found an old book and talked to a Hawaiian kahuna named Sam Lono. And he said that when the Hawaiians came to the island and landed on that side, there was a blonde and red-haired race living there when the Hawaiians first came there from Tahiti. And they even found a stone axe head that's in the Bishop Museum in Honolulu that they feel is Viking of origin. And that was just, I went, for sure, this is all real and it's amazing. And National Geographic, not too long ago, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, a photographer went over there and found these structures, and they put them in an issue of National Geographic. And of course, he took credit for finding them like they'd never been found before.
Yeah.
And I was on the radio, a good 10 years ago or 9, maybe, with George Nori on Coast to Coast. And he was real interested in this. And so I told the same story, and I got 880 emails. And, a couple was vacationing on Maui and wanted to go out there and look at it. I said, it's very treacherous. You better have lots of water, hiking boots, and it gets very hot because the sun radiates off of that lava flow. Well, they went out there and only got a few miles, and his wife got heat stroke, and he had to practically carry her to the car and went to a hospital.
Well, and it's a lava flow, and there are, you know, noxious fumes like, you know.
Well, no, it's not active now.
Oh, okay.
No, this is over. That lava flow is a few thousand years old in that area even. Well, no, there's no lava coming out or fumes. It's all dried lava.
Now, I find it interesting, as a tall redhead, I find it interesting how many cultures across the globe, whenever you're talking about giants in the Middle East, giants in America, when you're talking about these people from Mu, who the native Hawaiians, much like the Ute Indians, the Cherokee, things like that, say, stay away from these people, like they will eat you.
It's even
whenever you start getting into like Viracocha and start going down into the Mayan culture into Quetzalcoatl, they're all these redheaded folk. It's just always been very interesting to me. And
And you heard of the blonde Indian that they talked about in South American Indians. Yeah.
Well, and that's just it. Is it a DNA line that is passed on from antiquity? Is it something like that? What do the locals say about the people of Mu, their origin, where they come from, and where the Hawaiian people come from?
Well, the Hawaiian people came from Tahiti, and they feel that the Mu people, if you see a map, you can find that in Colonel Churchward's book, The Lost Continent of Mu. There's a map when the Hawaiian Islands were all up out of the water and how big it was, a continent. And a lot of the South American Indians say they came from there and went to South America, and then some of them migrated up here to America. And, you know, who knows if those giants or the Vikings and Scandinavian Nordic race was part of the people of Mu, you know, that's still... Churchward tries to explain a lot of it, and he even went down to South America and found all of these ruins and things that he felt were, you know, in the origin of the people of Mu, and that they taught a lot of the Indians there how to build those pyramids and those structures that they made. And it was all very entrancing to me, you know, and I kept studying it even after the band Mu disbanded, and I went on to my solo career. I kept studying it for years and years, and it's still something that I'm very interested in.
Well, and speaking of A, switching gears, B, switching music from Mu to that and topics from Mu to other studies. There are a couple other tracks that you sent me. One, Message from the Dome, which I really want to get into, because I do a lot of esoteric music. I do a lot of music that is playing with sonic sound, things like that, and a lot of experimental music. However, you have incorporated some pretty incredible frequencies and recordings at the beginning of Messages from the Dome, as well as Signals from Malibu. And I want to get into the origin of those signals before we play the tracks. So let's talk about Messages from the Dome first. And what the source of these signals were that you use at the beginning of the track, and
It's all about the end of the track also.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I was interviewed by an author named Michael Luckman, who was a ufologist, and he was writing a book on UFOs, and he interviewed me because I had had a sighting at the top of Haleakala Crater that got fairly well known, and he wanted to interview me about that. So he did a nice part in his book that came out, and I have a copy of it. And then he was contacted by an ex-World War II Army guy who liked ham radio, and he was retired in the hills of Malibu. And one night, he was talking to somebody in Australia, and these strange radio signals, and he knew code and all kinds of things, interfered. And he went, "What is this?" So he had a way of range finding, and it was about 3 miles out in the ocean. Under the ocean, he could tell it was coming from because there was nothing out there. And he started recording them. And he made these recordings, and he sent them to Michael Luckman. And Michael said, "You've got to send these to Merle Fankhauser." So he sent me these strange radio signals. And as soon as I started playing them, I went, "Oh, this is something." Well, in that area, Chris, for years, going back into the 40s, they at one point even thought it was some kind of Japanese submarine activity out there. They kept seeing things going in and out of the ocean, flying.
Yeah, yeah, out near the Catalina Islands, things like that. Those were regular sightings for decades and decades and decades.
Right, and so he sent me the signals. I went out in the studio and sat down at the piano at first with a click track going. And played the signals in my headphones, and I was just fiddling along with some piano parts, and all of a sudden I went, "Wait a minute, I better record this." And I remember I was started in E minor, hit the record button, and played for about 4 minutes or so, and it was giving me goosebumps.
Yeah.
And then I called the guys from the band in, and I said, "Listen to this." And they went, "What? What is that?" And you could hear the signals real loud in there. Mm-hmm. And then I went into a bridge in C major 7th, I remember. And my violinist was going, "You're playing in E minor, and you know those signals are in the key of E." And I went, "Really?" So it was almost like the signals were playing me.
Yeah, yeah, guiding you to what you were doing.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we finished the song, and everybody went, "Wow, man, we were so high, you know, we just
from the
couldn't
music.
Believe it."
From the music.
Yes, from the music. You didn't need a drug, man. This stuff... And we're going, "What is this?" And we were all sitting around, you know, in the control room with goosebumps. Yeah. And I said, "Let's go get some bowls of ice cream."
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm not sure how many people out there. Now, granted, like I said, I worked with jam bands, things like that. There is definitely that moment of synergy amongst musicians. But when you're talking about a piece like this, it's synergy on a different level, and it's getting things on a different level. And like myself personally, even with my music, there's only ever been like one person that I could quote jam with, Wes Goins. I love you out there, buddy. But he was the only one that after we played and that visceral energy came out of me and exuded, that it wasn't like, "Oh, did you feel that? That was weird."
Right.
Did you feel that? Do you think we could do it again?
Yeah. What happened, though, was then Michael got in touch with me, and he said, you know what? He said, the old guy that's living up there, he was talking to some people that were Chumash Indian related, and they said he was telling them, he was at a coffee shop or something there in Malibu, and they said, well, you know, there's a building under the water out there. And he went, what? And they said, yeah, you know, our tribe has been here for over 1,000 years, and when the ocean level was done, they could take their canoes out to the top of this building and sit on it like a pier and fish off of it.
Wow.
And so it goes down. Somebody said that it's on pillars. You can find it. You just type in Malibu anomaly and you can see it on the internet. I got the pictures for the CD cover. It's on the cover of my CD, and there's a big opening in the front. And they say that they feel like it's about 600 feet the pillars go down, and that they believed UFOs were going in and out of there. And at one point, I think James Cameron was even going to get involved, and they were going to send a robot sub with a camera into that opening. But something happened, and they never did it. Well, not too far up the coast from there is Point Magoo Naval Air Station. And I was on a radio show when the CD came out talking about it, and the DJ knew somebody that worked at the Naval Air Station. He called him up live on the air and said, yeah, I'm sitting here with Merle Fankhauser, and he's telling me about this anomaly that's under the ocean that things have been seen going in and out of for years. Do you know anything about that?
Wow.
And he said, yes, I know about it, but I can't talk about it. Goodbye. And the DJ started laughing. He says, well, that tells you a lot right there.
Yeah.
So here's one other thing, Chris, that's really something. The album came out. It's on Gonzo Multimedia, the label I'm on, and one of the labels in London. Big hit over there. Lots of radio play over here, and especially in California. And then I started doing one radio show after another, like we're doing, talking about this.
Yeah.
Them playing the whole song and the Signals from Malibu song. So here's what started happening. I was doing an interview with a station in London, and at the end, if you listen, there's a thing that sounds like a high-pitched lady's voice yodeling because it's oscillating. When that part came in, it shut the radio station in London down. It went off the air.
Wow.
Same thing happened on Ken Hudnall's station in, I think it's Austin, Texas. Same thing happened with a station up here in Sacramento. When it came to that part, shut them off the air. And they were all using newer digital audio boards, not analog.
Interesting.
The stations that had analog boards, it didn't affect. So I sent these signals to Bob Edwards that works for George Lucas.
Yep.
I've known him for quite a while, good engineer. I told him the story, and I said, Bob, can you analyze these? He got back to me right away, and he said, it's very odd, Merle. He said, there's not just one signal. There's a lower carrier signal, another signal, and the high signal seems to be some sort of message. There's three signals in what you sent me.
Interesting.
Then I noticed there were more of these signals left that I hadn't used. So I wrote Signals from Malibu that was a little more like a spacey, up-tempo, surf space song, you know.
Well, let's listen to the first one real quick. Part of it anyway. Okay. And hear these first signals from messages from the dome, because man, they are some amazing frequencies caught on tape. Is buried under the music the whole time is what I love. And just the care, like you said, the carrier tone inside of it is
the carrier was the first one you heard, the low thing, and then that higher one that was kind of oscillating is even louder on the very end of the song. And that's the one that Bob Edwards said the message was in.
Interesting. Yeah, and here that is right now.
Well, you went too far. It actually comes in a little bit before that. It's that high-pitched thing. Yeah, but... Yeah, and there is a video. There's a video on YouTube of this, and it has the pictures of the underwater anomaly. If you just type in at YouTube, Merle Fankhauser, Messages from the Dome, there's a video for that and a video for Signals from Malibu on YouTube. And there's pictures of this, and even pictures of objects that were seen going in and out that people sent me on that they took with their cell phones.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how long? Because, I mean, you once again go back into the realm of surfing in waters out near that area, things like that, for decades. Before this, were there sightings amongst folks in the surfing community? Were they regular, even in the folks of the elders that you talked with? Were these sightings, were these things regular, known about?
Yes, I went down there with a group of my surfing buddies from here in Pismo Beach, went down to Malibu to go surfing there. And we surfed during the day. There were some local surfers, and this was probably, oh, it might have been around 62 or somewhere in there. Yeah, I'd say 61 to 62 was 1962 was pretty close. And we got done surfing, and the sun was starting to go down, and these guys were building a campfire, and they said, "Oh, you guys ought to stick around and watch the lights go in and out of the ocean." And we went, "What?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, pretty regular. We see things darting in and out of the water." So we're driving home, and I remember Larry, one of my surfing buddies, he was laughing. He said, "Oh, they're seeing pelicans diving for fish." because that's what they do up here. And
sure,
when the sun's going down, it kind of glints off their wings and can look like something else, you know. And when I was on that same radio show I talked about up in San Luis Obispo, a person called in, a lady, and she said, I was a teenager in the late 40s, and my aunt and I, we lived in Malibu. We used to go down to the beach at night to watch the lights go in and out of the water, and that was in the late 40s. And so that had been going on for all of those years, and there we are. We could have experienced it in 1962, but people are still seeing it, and I wanted to take my camera crew. You know, I do a TV show called Tiki Lounge. I wanted to take the camera crew down there, and this was right at the beginning of when COVID hit, and, you know, nobody wanted to do it, and we still haven't done it, and I wanted to just take the van down there, sit there with the camera ready, you know, and when it gets dark, and see if we could catch something. But, you know, when people found out that I was doing this album and people heard about it, and then after the album came out, I hadn't had a video done yet, people started sending me these things that they had videoed with their cell phones. So I put some of that into the videos, and I have my band together. I have a big back lot. It looks like Hawaii, the way I've decorated it with a stage. And we've done now over 165 TV shows back there. And it's on in San Luis and Santa Barbara County. It used to be on in Santa Monica and Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Hawaii. But now we're, since the COVID thing, a lot of stuff has changed, and we're just down to the California area and Hawaii. But, man, it's another ongoing mystery.
And to know that you have been following this for the last 20, 30 years, that is pretty incredible, Merrill. That is a world of research and a world of gathering stories from elders in Hawaii, even stories from the West Coast of America. So, what has it been like for you to kind of bring all of this together and create art from it?
Well, it's something I was interested in from a very early age. My father being a flight instructor, and even before we moved to California, he would take me up at the in the local area at the airport in Louisville, Kentucky, and he was starting to teach me to fly then, you know, and he'd let me take the controls. I remember we had a J3 Cub at that time that he did a lot of instruction. And a pipe, a tailor craft that you sat side by side in, and instead of a stick, it had had two wheels. And I was interested in aviation from a young age and started making model airplanes and gliders. And I even made a flying saucer once that actually flew, you know, before Cox started making one with a little 049 engine in it. So I always asked my dad, I said, do you think that there really are UFOs? And he said, oh yeah. He said, there's got to be somebody else out there in the vast universe. And I was looking all my life for UFOs, and I never saw one till one night we were at the top of Haleakala Crater on Maui, and there was a bunch of tourists there, and it was a popular place to go to watch a beautiful sunset. We were all up there, the band, Moo, and myself, and a bunch of tourists, And as soon as the sun went down, all of a sudden this blue pulsating light came over the floor of the crater. And we went, what is that? And there was no sound, and it was dead quiet. And then two other lights came out of it and went up on each side, and they formed a tetrahedron, an inverted pyramid. And everybody's going, ooh. And there was an older gentleman that had been in the Navy standing next to me, and he said, all my years in the Navy, I never saw anything like this. And I'd say it was there for a good 4 minutes. It shined a light on the floor of the crater that lit up for, oh, a few seconds. And then the other two smaller ones converged back with the big one, and it shot straight up and disappeared.
Wow.
And that was 1974. And that was my first UFO sighting after looking for one all of my life.
And how did that change you? Was it the fact that from that point on you were looking for more, or was it from that point on things seemed to find you, Merle?
Well, both. I kept watching, you know, and you know, it seemed like, I don't know, you know, the guys in the band were always amazed at how fast I could write a song. And after I saw that, finally, my first UFO sighting, we drove down to our house in the little village of Haiku, and I had a reel-to-reel tape recorder in the corner so I could record these songs. And it turned on the recording, and out came my song, Calling from a Star, just like it was in my mind, and I just had to figure out how to play it, and I just sang it into the microphone, and we did a slow version on the second Moo album of it, and then I went back to L.A. to a proper studio and got some studio musicians together. And we recorded the version that came out on a 45 single in 1978 that was a radio hit. And I had some great musicians. Peter Noon from Herman's Hermits was doubling my voice on the chorus in there. And Gary Malabar from Steve Miller's band was on drums. And I wrote a song at the same time called The Mother Ship that we also recorded, and it was it's been a ride. And I had a chance to meet John Lennon once at Harry Nilsson's house when they were hanging out together one time up in the Hollywood Hills, and he and I were talking about songwriting, and he said he didn't write any of those songs in the Beatles. They were given to him by his muse. And I said, yeah. My best songs are written in 15 minutes. It's like they're being transmitted to me. And he looked at me and he called it automatic writing.
Mm.
And that stuck with me. And he said, you never know where or when a song is going to come to you. And if somebody starts talking to you or you hear another piece of music, it's gone. And that's why you need your solitude to let it come through, write it down, record it. And after that, I carried a cassette machine around with me, you know, portable all the time. And now over 450 songs written that I can remember that are recorded, you know, I still, every time I get that feeling, and now I have my own 24-track studio, and I go in and just turn it on, and there we go. Yeah.
I regularly talk, and I mean, like, talk. Like, I go out and speak at conventions about podcasting. I go out and part of what I tell people is that in ancient cultures, there was this concept called the muse and the hearth, you know, and there was a hearth in your home and there was a goddess of the hearth. And if your hearth was nice and plentiful and appeasing, the muse would come and poetry and music and all kinds of things would happen. Even now, like, I know we aren't on video right now, but whenever you see the video, you'll see the studio over my right hand shoulder. It's one button and go. I hit power. All of my synthesizers and effects come on and all I have to do is hit record.
That's great.
And start making music, because by the time you've set up equipment and gone into a digital audio workstation and made a track and gotten a project ready, you've spent 30 minutes. What happened to your muse?
See, I don't have to do that either. I just turn on this switch.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to go. I have a combination
of
digital and analog.
Exactly.
And
same,
I have an analog board because I like the sound of the analog board, and I have a lot of tube preamps and tube gear.
Yeah. No.
And I've done 16 albums in the studio I have now, and everybody goes, "What did you record this on? This is fantastic," you know?
Yep. Yeah. And really it is that necessity of synthesis between the analog and digital world, because for years I worked with tape and I still love tape.
Me too. I worked with a master editor, learned how to cut and splice tape and do edits.
It was a medium of its own, and it was one of those that whatever you were given to it, you better be given to it, buddy. You better be trying to get it in maybe 2 to 3 takes, but you better be trying to get it the first time around.
Exactly.
Because tape's expensive, and it don't sound right when you've recorded the same track 4 or 5 times and then punched it in and spliced it, you know?
I loved working, you know, we first started working in 8-track back in the day, and even 4-track. Well, Sergeant Pepper's was recorded on 2 4-track half-inch machines.
Well,
and then
what has it been like for you as a musician to go from that commit to the mix mentality, you know, of, hey, whatever reverb we're putting on it is what we're putting on it because we can't put it on in post? You know,
what
has the creative world been like for you with the birth of the inbox and the digital and everything else and the possibilities that provides?
Yeah, well, you know, we started out in 4-track, or actually some of the old Exiles were recorded live to 2-track. So you had the reverb was married to it. But then later on, when we got into the half-inch 4-track, they could put it on afterwards in 8-track. And I love 16-track, the analog, because the head spacing was wider and you could hit it at a higher dB rate, you know.
Yeah, saturated.
And I'm still recording, you know, at +4. And it's just wonderful. You know, all these labels, when I send them a demo or play it for them, even Warner Brothers loves my music and my my sound that I'm getting. I've recorded a lot of well-known people here in the studio that I have in my house, and I'm in a sequestered area and I have a big lot, you know, and nobody but the people that come here know what is really here, you know, with the building that's attached to my house and then the stage. It's, if you go look at some of the Tiki Lounge TV shows also, you can type in Merle Fankhauser's Tiki Lounge and you can see the backyard stage. I've had Canned Heat, Starship, Willie Nelson's been on the show.
Yeah.
There's a video of me and Willie Nelson on YouTube doing Wipeout. If you type in Merle Fankhauser, Willie Nelson, Wipeout. And, I've been blessed to have a lot of you know, all my old 60s friends, Dean Torrance from Jan and Dean. I did a nice interview with Mike Love of the Beach Boys, and it's just been wonderful, Chris. I just thank God and everybody for, you know, everything that I've been able to continue on and make a good living. And now all of my old songs are getting in movies and TV shows. I even had one of my songs from my Back This Way Again album, which was on released in 1990, only a woman on the show Young Sheldon.
Oh, wow.
I had Lila from the Fapper Dockley album, the collectible album. Yep. It first came out in 2018 in Chappaquiddick, the movie about Ted Kennedy.
Yep.
Then in 2019, I think they made the movie that came out in 2020, Trial of the Chicago Seven. They used it in that one, too. And then here, just a couple of years ago, it was in a TV show called In the Dark. And now, in the last 4 years, counting TV shows and movies, I've been in about 20 of them.
Amazing.
And it's really helping me financially, because the band and I haven't played a gig now since COVID hit, and it's been 2 years now, and two of the members of my band actually got COVID, and they're struggling with the after effects of it.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
Yeah, and I'm lucky, knock on wood, that hasn't happened. But I had some unfinished tracks, and we've tried to finish them. I sent a couple of them to Warner Brothers, and they liked them, but they're kind of still in lockdown because so many people from the label got COVID, and then in Burbank there, and then on the motion picture side is where Tom Hanks and his wife got it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and now we got this new variant that's going
variants
everywhere.
Variants galore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The new one, the BA2, they call it. A drummer friend of mine in Maui called me the other day, and he said, Merle, there was 600 new cases of it on Maui already.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it's scary, Chris. I don't know. Between that and then I look at the poor people in the Ukraine, it's just sad. It's like we're living in a sci-fi movie now.
And like I said in our pre-show conversation, Merle, I love the fact that folks like you, folks like Pink Floyd, have come together to put tracks out, to raise awareness for this, to bring a change of just mentality toward what is going on. You know, there's almost this normalized mentality to what is happening over there right now. And that's I think is the most frightening part is the numbness.
Yeah.
So
two stations in Poland are playing Peace in the World. Another station in Hungary is playing it. And I think I sent you that Hungarian article that was translated into English. It's in a magazine in Hungary there. They're doing a Greek article on it, and it's being played on the radio in Greece,
fantastic,
England, and Germany. And, you know, I'm Swiss and German, and my grandmother on my dad's side was full-blooded Wyandotte Indian. So I have some Native American in me. And I kind of felt when I moved to Maui that communicating with the Hawaiians, especially the older ones, something about that Native American thing helped me understand them. And they all seemed to like me so much, where as sort of what you said before, the Hawaiians are very suspicious.
Yeah, rightfully people. So.
And they, because the missionaries came there and tried to convert them from all of their ancient knowledge and their pagan ways. And so they call the white people that come there Howleys, you know, and watch out for the Howleys. But they loved me. I ended up playing for their baby birthday parties, weddings, funerals, everything. And I still have great Hawaiian friends there that communicate with me and email me and watch the TV show over there.
Well, Merle, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your knowledge about the Malibu anomaly. Such a strange case out there, such interesting things. Here in a second, we're going to go out with a little bit of the audio from Signals from Malibu. But before we do, let everybody know where they can go to get your albums, where they can go to find you, book you, get your band to play, get you to make music for movies, whatever. It is time for shameless self-promotion, my friend.
Okay, well, they can email me at merle@merlefankhauser.com, and I'll spell it real quick, merrell@merrell Fankhauser, FANKHAUSER. There's no R in the front of Fankhauser. There's even a village of Fankhauser in the Swiss Alps. And I have a website at merlefankhauser.com. And also, I want to plug my book, The Merle Fankhauser Story, Calling from a Star. And you can get that either direct from me, order it through the email, or direct from Amazon. And I'm proud to say it's sold quite well. And there are pictures in there, Chris, of all of those ruins that I discovered on Maui. The pictures, and there's a whole chapter devoted to my exploration there.
Mm. And once again, just absolutely amazing body of work, Merle. Everything that you have done, from your music to your research into this to the music that you have made from this, you have such an amazing career, such an amazing story to tell. Thank you so much for taking your time to come on, share your story with our audience, share everything, your music, all of it, for so long. Thank you for everything.
Chris, thank you. Thank you so much, too, for having me on. And let's stay in touch, and I'll give you updates on things that are happening. This has been great, and thank you for giving me so much time to tell all of those events that have happened, because when I look at it now, I go, how did I do this? Starting at 17 years old.
Yeah, no.
And it's never looked back, you know. I it's just amazing, and I just feel blessed to be able to have supported myself and done good in music these years.
You are one of the amazing few, Merle, who has had the opportunity to have a whirlwind of a career outside of one act. There's a lot of people that have had the longevity that you have, but it was typically inside of one act. You know, whenever you're talking about people like the Grateful Dead, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Eric Clapton, the Beatles, stuff like that, like all those people basically kept up what they were doing, but they didn't necessarily change what they were doing the way that you did so many times.
I went through so many genres.
Yeah.
I went through so many genres of music, and that's what all of these sync agents that I have in Hollywood and New York tell me, Merle, you have so many styles. This is just like a banquet, feeding these Hollywood producers that are making these movies and TV shows. I've got stuff from all different periods when they're making a period TV show or movie.
Yeah.
So I'm thankful.
Well, we're thankful as well. I know your fans are thankful. I know the folks that introduced me to your work are thankful for your work. And once again, thank you, thank you, thank you for taking the time to come on. I can't wait to have you on again and again to discuss The Land of Mu, the Malibu Anomaly, and other great things. Please do hold the line while we close things out with the amazing track, Signals from Malibu, folks. While we play that, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go to find all of the episodes. That's where you can go to find everything. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the knowledge vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.